Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Bonjour, nous allons commencer la dernière séance de ce séminaire consacré au culte de Mitra, dont la deuxième partie aura lieu la première semaine de décembre. Mon propre séminaire du Collège va continuer pendant quatre séances en juin, c'est annoncé sur le site, mais il s'agira de tout autre chose, il s'agira de documents bactriens. Ce sera assez technique, mais quand même accessible à, comme on va surtout naviguer dans des traductions, ce sera accessible à des gens non initiés à ces langues. Voilà. Bien, alors je vais commencer en anglais selon ce qu'on a convenu donc pour la langue de ce séminaire. In the first three sessions we considered new evidence, new thoughts about the Iranian cult of Mithra. And today I devote this session to a historian of Zoroastrianism or historian of religions, an archaeologist, David Bivar, because his works, very controversial, still play an important part in the Mithraic studies, especially Mithraic studies in Iran. He is very much considered as a reference. So, some preliminary words for those, actually a minority, support the idea of a continuity between Iranian and Roman Mithraism. There are, roughly speaking, three ways of conceiving it. First, according to Mary Boyce, the limited, but perhaps not so limited, Iranian features in the Roman mysteries cult can be explained by Zoroastrianism without any need to ascribe them to a pre-Zoroastrian stage. While admitting that such a stage existed, which she called Iranian paganism, she did not consider it relevant to explain the elements of the Mithra figure and the Mithra cult, which were transferred to the West in several stages during the 1st century BC and 1st century AD. The last and clearest presentation of her views are in her History of Zoroastrianism, abbreviated HZ, published in 1991. She did not really come back to it later on, but this is the most precise evaluation of the situation by her. Alors, second line of thinking. Contrary to Mary Boyce, Franz Cumont, the founder of the study of Western Mithraism at the turn of the past century, considered the mysterious cult as an offshoot of a pre-Zoroastrian Iranian cult of Mithra. As a label for this cult, Cumont sometimes put forward the name Zurvanism, still a vague concept in his time. He viewed Zurvanism as a combination of an Iranian substratum and Zoroastrian, with what he called Chaldean religious elements of northern Mesopotamia, mainly characterized by a strong reliance on astrology, astrological fatalism. Astrology is virtually absent from the Avesta, the founding text of Iranian Zoroastrianism. Thereafter, the progress of Mithraic studies during the 20th century was marked by a diversification of the supposed influences received during the westward journey of the Iranian cult of Mithra. In successive stages, scholars paid attention to Anatolian cults, sophisticated astrological developments possibly transferred from the Irano-Hellenic kingdom of Commagene to Rome at the end of the first century, philosophical reshaping in the framework of Stoicism and Neoplatonism, etc. As research developed in these directions, the postulated Iranian substratum, whether Zoroastrian or not, came more and more to be obliterated, to the point of being sometimes utterly denied. At this point came David Bivar's contribution, which gradually accrued with multiple offshoots during the last three decades of the past century. His basic idea, quite original in the beginning but eventually shared by others, was that the Iranian pre-Zoroastrian cult of Mithra was already an organized mysteries cult, markedly differing from Zoroastrianism as we know it. The origins of this mysteries cult was sought for not in Zurvanism, but in a postulated national religion of the Medes, the empire which had preceded the Achaemenian Empire. This religion of the Medes, he supposed, was imported in Western Anatolia by colonists from that region. Another doctrine of Bivar was that traces of these Iranian mysteries, or as he calls it, esoteric cult, could be followed not only in the West but also in Iran, and for a very long time, from echoes transmitted by Plato down to folkloric beliefs recorded in the 1940s. Bivar started to build his system in the early 1970s, at a time when Mithraic studies were receiving a fresh impulse with a succession of international conferences which provided him with a platform. The last expression of his views can be found in his book The Personalities of Mithra, a developed version of his Yarshater lectures presented at Los Angeles, UCLA, in 1994. References to his earlier contributions on these subjects are gathered here. Some words have to be said on David Bivar, whom I knew personally and was in very good terms with, like my teacher Paul Bernard, who nevertheless had given me this warning. Bivar excels in setting out very clearly the terms of a problem in the first pages of an article. Then he goes on developing the worst possible solution. Born in Bengal, Bivar served after the war as aide-de-camp of Sir Olaf Carrow, the last British governor of the Northwest Frontier Province, whom he assisted in the preparation of his authoritative book, The Pathans. Having moved to Oxford, he specialized in the study of coins and seals. He was acquainted with Walter Bruno Henning, the foremost philologist of Iranian studies at that time, although apparently he never was his student. At the same time, he acquired a direct experience of Kushan archaeology by taking part in the French excavations of the dynastic temple at Surkotal, where he excavated the fire sanctuary added in the Sasanian period. When working at Surkotal, he encountered, by chance, some native speakers of Arabic, and he was actually the first to report the existence of Arabophones in Afghanistan. Later on, he became an institutional figure, professor of Iranian studies at SOAS, and for a while, president of the Royal Asiatic Society. His academic standing, together with his eloquence and the vast erudition he generously shared with his interlocutors, can explain the attention which was always given to his ideas, even the strangest ones. His first Mithraic researchers were devoted to the origin of the iconographic motif of tauroctony, the bull slaying. While not being able to produce any proper image of tauroctony from Iran, he considered the motif of a lion slaying a bull or a deer frequent on coins of Achaemenian sub-rulers in Cyprus, Tarsus, and Byblos. He considers it as a direct forerunner of the tauroctony, with the animal predator symbolizing, taking the place actually of the victor god, either Mithra or a local god. He paid special attention to the particular gesture of the lion placing a paw on his victim's leg, which he considered unrealistic in animal representations and transposed from an anthropomorphic model, admittedly not documented at this stage, where the bull slayer was Mithra. He eventually proposed to recognize this typical Mithraic hold in other artistic productions, notably the battle scene. Yeah, you can see the foot on the leg, the battle scene on the famous so-called Alexander sarcophagus from Sido. And this, it was one of several associations between Alexander and Mithra Bivar postulated, and to which he eventually returned. Soon afterwards, his attention was brought again on the fighting lion by a relief on the Pergamon altar from the Hellenistic period, see here, which looked closer to the lion-headed man of Roman Mithraism. He also proposed to recognize a description of this hybrid figure here, in a passage of Plato's Republic, which had always puzzled the commentators. I read. It's a discourse on the human soul. Then, do you now model the form of a multitudinous, many-headed monster, having a ring of heads of all manner of beasts, tame and wild, which he is able to generate and metamorphose at will? Suppose now that you make a second form as of a lion, and a third of a man, the second smaller than the first, and the third smaller than the second. Next, fashion the outside of them into a single image, as of a man, so that he who is not able to look within and sees only the outer hull may believe the beast to be a single human creature. And men are blamed for pride and bad temper when the lion and serpent element in them, disproportionately grows and gains strength. Well, it's not very easy to understand what Plato has in mind. About this text, Bivar comments, "One could ascribe the incoherences of the passage to reluctance to reveal explicitly a cult secret, or to the account referring to an actual image." Indeed, Bivar supported the idea, held by a minority of scholars, that Plato had inherited close contacts with the Persian power through members of his family who had acted as ambassadors, and that he became personally acquainted with specifically Western manifestations of the Persian religion through conversations with Magi he met in Phoenicia. According to this view, such acquaintances were later on censured in Plato's official biographies produced by the Academy of Athens. All that, of course, is extremely controversial. One must admit that Bivar's conception of the role of the lion-headed demon is not entirely clear. From Plato's passage just quoted, it appears as a symbol of the lowest instincts of the human soul. But Bivar admitted that this cannot be the case with the figure in the Western Mithraea. For this figure, he hesitated between Zurvan, hitherto admitted by Cumont because of the encircling snake being a symbol of time, and Ahriman, documented by at least one inscription accompanying such an image. It was mentioned by Nina in her speech. His unease is well expressed by his statement. Perhaps the difference between Ahriman and Zurvan is no more than a question of viewpoint rather than essence. Eventually, Bivar complicated these quite eclectic views by assuming that at the time he was transferred to the West, the Iranian Mithra had already received some features from the Babylonian god Nergal, consequently mutating into a god of death and the underworld. For this specific, this is an image of Nergal from Hathra. Well, for this specific idea, he would probably have welcomed the recently image of Mithra holding an axe on a ossuary from Samarkand. I am going to publish now. Well, nevertheless, may I be allowed to confess that I do not see much of Nergal on this Samarkand Mithra, but definitely something of Zahak on the Hathra relief, with a specific detail of the snakes rising from the shoulders. It's most probably one of the iconographic sources for the image of Zahak, both described in the Shahnameh and illustrated in Persian miniature, already in Sogdian painting. Well, early in his research, Bivar had turned his attention to the opposite side of the Iranian world, where coins of the last Greco-Bactrian and Indo-Greek kings seem to provide less disputable evidence. I must remind that Bivar's initial technical training was numismatics. Here, on these coins, images of Mithra had been already identified in 1938 by the American numismatist Edward Newell, without getting the attention it deserved. Bivar, in his article, Mithraic Images of Bactria, Are They Related to Roman Mithraism?, presented in the famous conference Mysteria Mithrae, held in Rome and published in 1979, he discussed further specimens and integrated this evidence into his already imposing scheme. The first presumed Mithra images are found on coins of the last Greco-Bactrian king Plato, who ruled a short time in about 145 BC. Of course, Bivar did not fail to suppose a link between the name of the king and the Mithraic sympathies of the philosopher Plato he had tried to demonstrate, but we do not need to follow him so far. Actually, some coins depict a radiate god on a chariot, a quadriga. This time is present already in the Greek iconography of Helios, but Iranians could well interpret it as Mithra, as is described in his Yasht, precisely driving a quadriga. And that image of Mithra in the quadriga continued to be depicted both in the East and in the West. This is one contact point between the iconography of Mithra in the East and the West. Other coins of Plato show the god, still radiated here, the god standing, holding a scepter, and clad as an Iranian, exactly as Mithra will appear later on Kushan coins, where he is actually named Miro. On issues by two later Indo-Greek kings, Amyntas and Hermaios, the god's Iranian identity is definitely proclaimed by the tiara set in the middle of the rays, a combination which will reappear a few decades later in the Nimrud Nag. On one type, the radiant god with a tiara here continues Greco-Bactrian images of Zeus Olympios enthroned. And in this instance, Bivar supposes an alternate assimilation of Mithra to Zeus rather than to Helios Apollo. This time of an enthroned Jovian Mithra is actually found again in Kushano-Sasanian coins inscribed with the name Mithra. On some coins of the Greco, of the Indo-Greeks, the Mithra's head is coupled on the reverse by a horse, Mithra's sacrificial animal. And this horse is still found side by side with a very similar Mithra head on coins issued in Pontus under Commodus. These coins were not mentioned by Bivar, but Harry Falk has recently drawn attention to them. At this point, it becomes quite difficult to exclude the possibility of a common iconographic archetype eventually inherited by Bactria, Commagene, and Pontus. Subsequently, Bivar chose again to move on a most shaky ground. This time, the incentive was not provided by coins, by an epigraphic discovery, the Stela of Xanthos, a city in western Anatolia, in Lycia, first published in 1974. This stela was set up by Pixodarus, satrap of Lycia in the late Achaemenian period, and it contains a dedicatory inscription in three languages: Lycian, Aramaic, and Greek. Protection on the sanctuary of Leto is asked to her children, Apollo, Artemis, and the nymphs. But in the Aramaic version, instead of the nymphs of an Apollo, we find respectively, the Auranish, daughters of the Ahura, personification of the waters in the Avesta, and Kshasrapati. The editors of the inscription immediately recognized that Kshasrapati, master of the kingdom, functions here as a byname of Mithra, who is himself the expected equivalent of Apollo. Truly, Kshasrapati's alleged attestation in the Persepolis tablets has been dismissed now in favor of another etymology. But Kshatrapati was indeed an epithet of the Vedic Mithra. This is not the only case when Iranian gods are provided in Greek and Roman inscriptions with epithets not attested in Iran, but nonetheless perfectly explainable from an Iranian point of view. Starting from this evidence, various scholars have put forward the idea that Kshasrapati pursued a career of his own in the Near East, being the source of the Theos Satrapes, the satrap god, in Elis in Greece, and the warrior god Shadrapa in Syria Phoenicia. All this is disputed. As his own contribution, Bivar brought Sarapis into the debate, and to this he devoted a lot of work. Sarapis, as you know, was a Greco-Egyptian god promoted very energetically by the Ptolemaic dynasty of Egypt. Challenging the frequent but not anonymous explanation of the name Sarapis as derived from Osiris Apis, and the classical story of the cult's creation in Ptolemaic Egypt, Bivar saw in the name Sarapis an outcome of a proto-Middle Iranian form, Sharbed, itself derived from Shastrapati. Linguistically, the argument is defendable, although not compelling, but the historical reasoning is very speculative. Concerning the adoption of the specific title Shastrapati for the Mithra of Xanthos, Bivar paid great attention to the supposed Median origin of the satrap Pixodarus who ordered the inscription. Also, for an Iranian origin of the cult of Serapis, he claimed that Serapis was already on the stage at the time of Alexander's death in Babylon, long before Ptolemy I instituted his cult in Egypt. Truly, some accounts of Alexander's death, Arrian, Plutarch, mention that Serapis was then consulted in his sanctuary in Babylon, but the details of Alexander's death are a puzzle for modern historians, as they were already for the authors of the ancient accounts we have. For a complete and perceptive discussion, I refer to an article by Pierre Chuvin, La mort d'Alexandre, Histoire et légende, Grèce, Babylone, Memphis, in the volume La mort du souverain entre Antiquité et au Moyen-Âge, published in 2020. Chuvin, after some others, supposes that Serapis' name was substituted for that of a second-ranked Babylonian god, probably Ea, master of the underworld, but at the same time a helper, and who had his own chapel in the Esagila temple of Babylon. The intrusion of Serapis can be ascribed to a later manipulation of the source material in Alexandria, a manipulation of the same type as the mixture which eventually gave rise to the Alexander Romance. Bivar did not fail to look in Iran for a continuation of this esoteric cult of Mithra, or as he sometimes preferred to write, Serapis Mithra, Sharbed Mithra. In fact, what he claimed to have found in Iran was neither plentiful nor continuous, as he himself admitted. I quote, "The question, contentious to be sure, of possible survivors of esoteric Mithraism under the Sassanians." He proposed to recognize a continuation of the lion-headed Ahriman, an Sassanian magical seal. But the divine personal invoked in the Pahlavi inscription belongs to the circle of Sesen, an intercessor god of Western Semitic origin. And the lion face is not obvious. I rather inclined to recognize on this figure on features of insects, creeping creatures rejected by Zoroastrianism. More lion-looking is the figure of a winged demon on some amulets from the Buyid period. Here. But we are not obliged to follow Bivar when he writes that this represents a survival of the figure from Mithraism seems evident. Well, for me, it is not evident at all. Of course, Bivar paid attention to the Mithraism of Dura Europos, which, together with some others, he considered influenced by Iran. Concerning the hunting scene, he wrote, "It has distinct Iranian features, and we may notice accompanying the hunter not only the lion, symbol of Mithra himself, but the boar, emblem of Verithragna, the god of victory, and of course the enigmatic serpent." If one considers, I continue the quotation, If one considers the possible symbolism, it is not difficult to visualize the concept of Mithra both as the creator of life, the message of the Tauroctony, and as a god of death, whose victims, represented here by the herbivores, are one by one struck down by the unerring arrows. End of quote. Well, while not necessarily disagreeing with him for the last part of this statement, one must notice that the lion and the boar are present here as quarries, not as symbols specifically associated with the god. The running wild boar is not the boar-shaped Verithragna described in the Miriasht as running in front of Mithra's chariot, but one of the hunted animals, as indicated by the two arrows, which Bivar did not notice because he worked on imprecise photographs. But the arrows are clearly seen on the original, now exhibited in Yale University. Bivar continued subsequently to follow the track of the royal hunt, the importance of which in Sasanian silverware he ascribed to a particular association between the king and Mithra. Refining this interpretation to the extreme, he proposed a new reading of the famous episode in which Bahram Gur, the heir of the throne, at the request of his favorite Al-Zada, converts a male gazelle into female by cutting off its horns with an arrow, and a female into a male by lodging two arrows in his head. Here you can see, the male, well, actually is doing something as he's fixing the ear to its leg, but other images show the the female, the male gazelle with the horns cut, and the female gazelle with the two arrows fixed in its skull. The specific point is the girl's words. Excuse me for my Persian accent. Kenizak Badugov, Ahrimani, Udgar Nabad, Ishan Kojovgani. The girl said to him, "You are Ahriman. Were it not so, how could you have shot this?" In Bivar's interpretation, Bahram was a devotee of esoteric Mithraism, and the girl's mention of Ahriman had invoked his Mithraic oath, forcing him immediately to slay the speaker. This is indeed what was prescribed among the Yazidis until the 19th century. Apparently, among the Yazidis, if somebody heard somebody else mentioning the name of Satan, he had to kill him immediately and then to commit suicide. I must admit, however, that in my pedestrian approach, I consider that calling the royal prince Ahriman was enough of alleged majesty to deserve a death sentence. Bivar's mention of the Yazidis brings us to the last angle of his approach of underground Mithraism in Iran, namely a putative survival in marginal circles until the past century. In the first session of this seminar, Samra Hazarnoush has mentioned Richard Fry's closing words in his intervention at the Manchester Mithra Conference in 1975. The aberrant forms of the cult in Western Mithraism are not found in Iran until archaeologists or ethnologists one day uncover traces of some of the practices of Western Mithraism in the mountains of Kurdistan. What Fry did not know, or perhaps chose to ignore, is that such traces had been already reported by Robert Zeiner in an article, Zoroastrian Survivals in Iranian Folklore, published in the journal Iran, the first part in 1965, the second one posthumously in 1992. Zeiner held the chair of Eastern Religions and Ethics at Oxford, and he published important, albeit today outdated, books on Zoroastrianism and especially Zurvanism. Previously in Iran, he had been an active collaborator of MI5, the British intelligence service. So was also David Bivar, but less conspicuously. At least, contrary to Zeiner, Bivar did not participate in the overthrow of Mossadegh. To cut a long story short, by the end of the war, Zeiner employed in Tehran a young man called Ali Mirdrekvandi, a tribesman from Luristan, who had managed to teach himself English and to compose in this language two thick books of fiction, No Heaven for Gungadin, which was published later on, and Irradiant, of which only summaries and extracts are accessible. The first book can be described as a parodic tale of an ascent to heavens through the Milky Way. The second book is a more ambitious cosmological narration. Zeiner was immediately struck by similarities with Zoroastrian accounts, of which I just mentioned a few. The initial opposition, it's set up in Irradiant, the initial opposition between heavenly God and lionish God, followed by an attack of the latter, concluded by an agreement between the two powers to wage war until either is destroyed. Lionish God then controlled the earth during 3,000 years, claiming to be omniscient and omnipotent, while in fact he is not. Consequently, in the final battle, he is defeated by the champion of heavenly God, the boy Irradiant, in Persian Nur Afghan, which actually means projector. The victory is followed by a 6 day rite called the General Origination Days, in order to commemorate the creation of the world. I notice that this last detail, not commented by Zeiner, is particularly reminiscent of the final Yasna described in the anthology of Zatsparan, a major Zoroastrian book on these doctrines. All that was convincing enough, but Zeiner, and even more Bivar, tried to look further and to recognize a deeper Mithraic stratum. The main argument was, of course, the lionish god assuming the role of Ahriman, and which, by an audacious leap in reasoning, they assimilated with the lion-headed Deus Ahrimanus of Western Mithraism. Actually, the lionish god is not especially described in Mirdrekvandi. It's not stated that he's a human with a lion head. He's just lionish god. Stretching his imagination even further, Bivar proposed an utterly wrong but nonetheless fascinating etymology for the name Mirdrekvand, Mirdrekvandi's native quarter in the village of Raihan, the place of the chief of the Drugwand, establishing a link with a community rejected by Zoroastrians. There is no need to pursue this fantastic story, the more so as most of Mirdrekvandi's original work is not yet accessible. Surely, more research is needed on his sources, which appear not to have been all oral. Actually, Bivar, contrary to Zeiner, questioned Mirdrekvandi's self-story of an uneducated tribal thinker. In fact, Mirdrekvandi had concealed that he had attended school. He was literate in Persian, including poetry. At the end of his life, although quite a tramp, he was known in the literary circle of Burjerd. When in Tehran, he might have encountered Zoroastrians. And moreover, in early Pahlavi Iran, and surely in Zeiner's library, the main Zoroastrian texts were accessible in English through the well-distributed collection Sacred Books of the East, published in the 1880s. perhaps one does not need to look further to explain his possible acquaintance with some passages of the Bundahishn, Zatzpram, and the Zandivamanyasna. To conclude, having surveyed all this, even in a simplified way, there is a temptation to dismiss Bivar's Mithraic work as a loss of time, to be relegated to the big books of scholarly teratology. Obviously, he proceeded by a steady accretion of hypotheses, never questioning previous assumptions and without any real concern to construct a coherent system. When looking in detail, quite many contradictions can be found, which he never tried to solve. Nevertheless, it would be unfair to throw away his immense effort. Some parts of it still deserve consideration, in particular what he wrote on coins, which was his first field of expertise. And most importantly, his work keeps an important place in historiography. It stands at the background of much recent research. At least one authoritative Iranologist, Philip Kreienbrock, Neil Mackenzie's successor in Göttingen, takes Bivar's idea seriously in his own research on the sources of secret doctrines of the Yazidis and Al-Iraq. In his introduction to Zehner's second article, he tentatively suggested that the link between underground Mithraism and Mirzek Vandi might have been some member of his family initiated into the Al-Iraq. Other researchers are now taking the theory of an esoteric. Iranian Mithraism to some extremes, for which Bivar cannot be held responsible. I have in mind especially Abolola Sodovar and Parmane Purshariati. While I enjoyed to survey Bivar's work, I prefer. To leave the evaluation of his epigones to others. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.